I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Elizabeth O'Connor about her literary novel, Whalefall. Elizabeth lives in Birmingham. Her short stories have appeared in The White Review and Granta, and she was the 2020 winner of the White Review Short Story Prize. She also holds a PhD in English Literature from the University of Birmingham. In this episode, we discuss how she created a fictitious island community, her technique for overcoming problems with plotting, and how she signed with an agent before she even had an idea for a novel. But before we hear that, here's Elizabeth with an excerpt from Whalefall.
I had only been a month away from school. The school was in an old farm building owned by the chapel, large enough for the 10 or so children on the island to be taught in its two rooms. We had a desk each, damp wood, and mostly read the Bible. Sister Mary and Sister Gwennon came for a few months at a time, in between teaching at a school on the mainland. The books they brought us had stamps on the front cover, reading Our Lady of the Wayside in faded gold lettering. We wore white on special days like St. Dwynwen's Day. I had a friend at school. Rosalind sat next to me for 10 years and then went to the mainland to marry a quarry worker in Pitheli, a man with a pink face and an uncoined mouth. Rosalind had met him a few times before she left, visiting his town when her father rode to the mainland market. At the back of the classroom, she confided in me about his meaty breath, the things he said to her. On the day she left the island, her father had filled his small boat with flowers and grass. His crying could be heard from the dunes. Rosalind had curly hair and a round face that shone always with sweat. I always thought she looked like a model I had seen once on a small card that came with a bar of soap. She sent me a letter after she married, saying she missed me, that she lived in a house with an indoor toilet. The end of her letter asked me what I was doing and what I planned to do. I had not replied. I was good at school. Sister Mary called me bright and let me visit her on Saturdays, when she would show me large maps and let me borrow her English novels. When one of the boys applied to a university in England, he asked Sister Mary to check his application, and Sister Mary asked me to do it. I left two spelling mistakes in on purpose, but he still got a place. He said that he would write to me about it, but he never did. His mother showed me a photograph of him on a boat on the river, wearing a long black coat. I had begged to keep the photograph, not because of the boy in it, but because his face was slightly washed out, meaning that I could pretend the person in the boat was me. On the last day of school, my teacher had not even said goodbye. She said, "I'll see you at the market."
Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Whalefall.
Thank you so much for having me. So pleased to be here.
So, Elizabeth, can you start by explaining what Whalefall is all about?
Yes, of course. So, Whalefall is set on an isolated island off the coast of Wales, just before the Second World War in 1938. And it's about a young woman who lives on the island and her family, and the arrival of two anthropologists who from England who have come to the island to study this way of rural way of life and their folklore and folk song and customs. And it's about the young woman, the protagonist, getting a bit mixed up in what they're doing and how that impacts her and her family on this island. So that's the plot. And then I suppose I always like to think about what it's about right at the heart of it, which I'd say it's about community and isolation, and also about a young person sort of grappling with a really uncertain future, and about landscape and changes in that landscape, how they affect us and affect our future as well.
Oh, there's just so much I loved about this book, and it's set on an island, it's about community, it's all the things that I love, and I was just, you captured it so beautifully. But I would love to know kind of where it all began, where did the idea come from, and also, like, you did forget to mention one important thing in your description, the whale. I mean, tell us about where the whale idea came from.
Yeah, so the whale was kind of one of the really early things that came for the novel. So I had this sort of interest in islands that orbit the British Isles, that had, I guess, sort of tumultuous circumstances in the first half of the 20th century. So we're either formally evacuated or we're sort of facing a gradual depopulation. That was kind of going on in my head. And I went to a talk at a conference I was at, by a researcher called Sophia Niklov, who was a PhD student at the time. And she did this paper about whale beachings. And in that context, it was in Canada, I think, or in North America. And it was about the way that these whale beachings affected the community that lived there, the way it kind of became a spectacle that became part of their sort of cultural language and part of them, and I was really interested in that idea of how a natural phenomenon could impact a community and what might come from that, what it might put into motion. So that kind of became combined with these ideas I was thinking about these islands and their histories and these kind of lost communities almost, that now no longer exist on these islands. That kind of connection between what might happen to a community during these natural phenomena and that history behind them. And I think that kind of combined into the seed of the novel. Mm.
What was it about the kind of island life and kind of isolated communities that really interest you?
So I did my PhD on coastal poetry in modernism. And with that, I was really interested in, a couple of things. So one is the way we understand coasts. They kind of come to symbolise places of flux and change. And also, they also have these very real implications for our age of climate change. We know that shores are particularly vulnerable. So I had these ideas of climate change and the kind of changing nature of a coast in my mind, and islands in particular sort of really typify that, because they're surrounded by a coast, and that sense of isolation that a barrier of water between you and the mainland gives you is particularly heightened. And I think the other thing with islands was also wanting to reflect a little bit on the UK itself as an island, that we are in a way an island nation, and we have being an island as part of our identity. It's often used I think in quite negative ways. So particularly around Brexit, we had a lot of things about this idea of us being physically separate from Europe, or we have quite dangerous narratives around immigration that sort of take this idea of us as an island under threat and our shores being under threat as their central language. So this idea of setting something on an island, I felt would also give me an opportunity to think about what it means to have that islandness as part of your identity and of how you define yourself.
Yeah, it's fascinating. My novel's set on an island as well, and I just find that whole concept of people being kind of separate, and that we'll talk about it in a bit, but that kind of relationship to the mainland as well is fascinating in your novel. Where did the title come from? Did you come up with that idea, or was that a discussion with your editor?
That was my idea, and titles are something I normally find so hard. I can never properly land on a title, but this one was there from quite early on. A whale fall is it's a scientific term, I suppose, for when a whale dies and falls to the bottom of the ocean, and is sort of eaten by worms, bacteria, various different parts of the deep ocean ecology, and in doing so kind of forms its own ecology around its carcass. You know, worms come to eat it, and then things come to eat the worms, and so on. So for the novel, it frames it as kind of a narrative about something ending, I suppose, but also something beginning, this kind of new ecology growing and taking place.
Let's talk about is it Manod? Is that
Manod?
Is that how you pronounce
that's
her name?
right.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's talk about her a little bit. She's your central protagonist, and I wondered if you could just speak a little bit about the kind of, I guess, the changing feelings she has towards being on the island and what the mainland represents. You did in your reading talk, like, gave us a little glimpse into other people that she loves leaving and how that feels for her. So can you tell us a little bit about her feelings?
So Manod's an 18-year-old girl who's kind of grown up on this island with her family, and now that she's 18, she's kind of facing a bit of a choice about what she wants her life to be and how she sees herself. She's in this kind of dilemma, I suppose, of having her family on the island being her home, but also wanting a bit more for herself. So in the reading, she talks about someone from the island who's gone to university on the mainland and imagining that they're her. She's very intelligent, very academic, but doesn't have many opportunities available to her to pursue that or to think about that as part of her future. So she's someone really grappling about what her potential might be and how she might fulfill that, and but also feeling very tied to her family on the island.
And things change obviously when the anthropologists arrive from England. Can you tell us a little bit about how their arrival disrupts things? And what I really enjoyed as well is that partway through the novel, once they arrived, you get kind of glimpses into the observations that they're making, and the also inclusions of I guess like an oral history of the island and kind of folklore and songs and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit about their arrival and what it does to the island?
Yeah, of course. So there's two anthropologists who arrive on the island, Edward and Joan, and yes, as I said in my description of the book, they come to study the island as this way of life that's perhaps dying out, or that with modernization on the mainland is a bit rare and unusual. So the first thing they do is they employ Manod as a kind of translator, so everyone on the island speaks Welsh, so she becomes their translator and a bit of a secretary, doing various little jobs for them. So she becomes quite entangled with them and their work. And as you say, that the novel starts to reveal what their work is on the island. So transcripts of their interviews with people on the island, as well as their notes, sort of showing what their perspective of the island is. And I hope I'm not giving too much away by saying it slowly comes to light that they're perhaps not quite what they seem, and their intentions are not quite as heroic
I think
as man
probably
or
by the
things.
Moment they step on the island, we get a feeling that, maybe then their intentions aren't the best. I think as well what you managed to capture, because we're seeing the world through Maynard's eyes, and feeling her, despite her feelings for the mainland, she has a real kind of compassion for the island itself and the way of life, and obviously the island is so important to her, and there are the history of it and the tradition of it is really important. And when these people come and they're kind of making fun of it and asking questions, and you feel that hurt, that pain, because you're thinking, how dare you come and like criticize their way of life or their diet or their kind of methods. And it's very hurtful to kind of, because we're seeing it through her eyes and seeing how they, in a very kind of subtle way, belittle her life.
Yes, that's right.
Can you talk a little bit about the kind of folklore and tradition that the islanders have? Because that's something that's really important to their way of life.
Yeah, so part of my inspiration for the book was, as I said, wanting to think about how a culture is built around the nature it inhabits. And one of the main ways I think we've done this historically is in things like folklore and idiom and folk song even. I was also really influenced by my own grandmother, who came from quite a tiny isolated village in Wales, moved to the mainland, and herself sort of, when we were children, always talk through these folk tales and folk songs that were felt very much rooted in the landscape that she had come from and were sort of part of this landscape that she'd carried with her. So I really wanted to explore the way those folk songs and folk tales kind of connected this community to their way of life and the landscape they lived alongside. And sort of, I think the novel thinks about where that goes. So through the anthropologists and the way they bring their own assumptions about the landscape or the way these people live, what the difference is between these kind of urban eyes and this community and how they express themselves.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about your research, because although this island, it feels incredibly real, it's a fictional place that you've built as a kind of amalgamation of different islands. Could you tell us sort of a little bit about how you went about building this place and where your research took you?
Yeah, so there are a few islands, as you say, that I kind of took inspiration from. The main ones being so Bardsey Island in Wales, which I think became uninhabited generally. I think there's still sort of transient people living there, like lighthouse keepers and looking after the natural resources there, but generally depopulated by sort of 1960, I want to say. And then also St Kilda in Scotland and the Blasket Islands in Ireland, which were both formally evacuated in the 30s and in the 50s respectively. So those were the real places that I really took inspiration from, and I read a lot of memoirs from people who lived there at the start of the 20th century. People like Peg Sayers, who wrote a lot about the Blaskets, Maurice O'Sullivan. There's a great memoir of Bardsey Island by an artist called Brenda Chamberlain, who writes about the island but also does a lot of small paintings and sketches that she publishes with her writing. And then the other thing I was looking at was, from the anthropologist's perspective, to sort of think about them, was how these islands might have been perceived in more popular culture at the time. So for instance, Morris O'Sullivan, who wrote the memoir about living on the Blasket Islands, E.M. Forster was really into this work, but he also described it as like the remnants of a Neolithic culture or something like that, this very sort of loaded phrase which was meant as a compliment but also had quite a lot of, it's also quite condescending to describe this rural community as Neolithic. And I think there's a bit of sort of class misunderstanding there as well. And there was also a film that came out in the 30s called Man of Arran, which is about the Arran Islands, which are thriving now. And this film was billed as a documentary. It was an American director, came out in 1934, and used sort of real footage of the islands and of people who lived on the islands, but also fabricated quite a lot. So they created families from the islanders that they felt were the most photogenic, and sort of got them to do these very strange rituals with whale sharks in the water, which was actually really dangerous for the islanders to be doing. So I was interested in that kind of fabrication of island life that was being presented as something that was very true. So yeah, that real contrast between island life through memoirs, but also how it was being portrayed into more urban and intellectual city life as well.
I wondered then, when you're saying about this research that you're doing, did you have kind of mood boards or Pinterest boards or anything to help you?
I did, yes. I'm a big fan of a mood board for sure. I had a big collage that I just make on Canva with different photographs of the islands at the time that I could find, but also generally isolated places and paintings and yeah, different little sources.
Did you draw like a little map for yourself so that you knew where certain things were?
Yes, I did. And I had a list of every single islander and what their name was, and how old they were and what they were like, so that I could always know sort of who was in each scene and really picture it. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been there, done that. So I get worried that's necessary, because sometimes you think, hang on a minute, did I say that was in the north? Did I say that was?
Yes. Oh,
yeah, you're kind of trying to work all those things out. And
exactly.
I don't know about you, but trying to work out kind of how many miles the island was wide across or things like that. Crazy research we have to do as writers, but there we go. So we've talked about the research a little bit, but I wonder whether there was any other aspect of the novel that you found particularly difficult or challenging.
Something I always struggle with is plot, I would say. I always really, that's the bit I find most challenging about writing anything, whether it's a novel or a short story or any form, really. It's those real structural issues of when things happen and what is seen and how the story is told. Other things fall into place, like setting and character for me, but plot and structure is definitely something that always takes up a lot of my time and that I find really, really challenging.
So how do you kind of go about getting over that challenge then? Do you have any particular way that you work? Like, do you have you kind of forced yourself to be a plotter a bit more? How do you kind of go about it?
Yeah, force myself to be a bit more of a plotter, definitely. I think I try and read a lot, which I think a lot of writers are doing anyway. But if I find a book that I think really has a plot or a structure that I could take something from, whether it's the structure of a single scene or the whole thing, I really try and think very carefully about the moving pieces of it. So I use a few like Excel spreadsheets where I'd sort of write down the beats of the plots in these other books and then try and line up my narrative, not ex exactly, but just to have that sense of a template or a skeleton that I could use, just to get things on the page and then move them around a bit later. Yeah.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So I'd love to hear a bit more about your kind of history as a writer and find out whether you've written things before. Evan, was this your first ever attempt to write a novel, or have you kind of had various goes before and then put them away and thought, no, this is not for me? Or was this your first go?
I wrote an absolutely awful novel when I was a teenager. that was my first attempt. Trying to think if there's a copy of that anywhere, but I don't think there is, which is a relief to me and everyone. Yeah. I've definitely been writing for a long time before Whaleful was picked up, mainly short stories though, I'd say. And yeah, it's you spend a lot of time in that preparation stage, I think. It felt to me as though, or feels to me as though, I've been writing for a good 10, 15 years before now, just constantly trying to get work into places and failing, trying to finish something, realizing it's not working. Yeah, the real business of being a writer, I think, is that part.
Can you remember when writing for you turned from being kind of something you did just for fun, and then you thought, I want to take this seriously and try and get my work published? Can you remember that turning point?
I think a big turning point was when I finished my PhD a few years ago, which was in English, and I'd done it because I wanted to be a academic in English, and sort of got to the end and realized that I really liked writing fiction, and that that was maybe something I wanted to pursue more of, but had a bit of a choice where if I'd gone down the academia route, I probably would have had very little time for writing, especially at first. So it would have been very much not doing that, or taking a bit of a chance and seeing if I could write alongside a different kind of day job that maybe had more set hours. And so, yeah, I think that was a point where it was really a choice of whether I was actually going to pursue writing or accept that it would be a hobby that would come and go.
You mentioned about short stories. Were you kind of writing to submit to literary mags and competitions and things like that.
Yes, definitely. Was always trying to get into literary magazines and competitions. Mainly because I think the deadline is such a good way to force you to actually finish something. Yes. And sort of, just getting that sense of what's out there, who different people are, what different routes into writing are, exploring the scene, I suppose. Mm.
So how did you come to get your agent and your book deal?
So I was really lucky with agents. So in sending off lots of short stories, I was published in The White Review, which sadly is no longer going, but it was an amazing magazine. So was published there as part of their short story prize, and that meant that a few agents got in touch with me to sort of ask if I was working on anything longer. And that was a few years before I actually finished a novel manuscript. So they got in touch and I didn't really have anything to send. I had a couple of conversations with people, but ultimately had to say, actually don't have anything finished. I don't even really have a partial thing I can show you. And so then it was about 2 years, I think, before I finished the manuscript of Whalefall and was able to send it, get back in touch with those people I'd spoken to. And then luckily from that, one of them ended up signing me.
Did you feel pressured? Because I think if you get kind of any kind of response from agents, it's that feeling of, oh God, I've got to act now. Otherwise they might disappear or they might lose interest in me. Did you feel that kind of pressure? Did that hinder your ability to kind of come up with any ideas because you had at the back of your head? And agents are interested, they want something? Or were you kind of more relaxed about it and just thought it'll happen when it happens? How did you approach that?
It was massively a huge pressure, as you say, that feeling of having this opportunity to actually send something to someone but not actually having anything that you can send. It was really it felt really pressurized, and I was really worried that by the time I'd actually finished writing anything, they'd have forgotten about me or weren't interested anymore. So it was a huge pressure. However, I think it's true that things happen when they happen, and sometimes you can't force something. Things do take time to do in the way that you want them. In the way that you want to do them, and looking back, I think that's what I tell myself, that it's fine and you can take your time to write the best thing that you can write, and then send that off.
I'm interested to know with your particular situation whether you had a full manuscript when you went back to these agents, or had you just got kind of an idea and maybe the first three chapters? How did that work?
No, I had a full thing that I sent off. I really struggle to send off anything that's not completely finished. I don't know if it's linked to struggling with plot and structure, but I really find that I want to see the whole thing and understand.
Well, things change so much, don't they? Because
yes,
if you're sending three chapters, that's, let's say that's three well edited, lovely three chapters, but in the context of a first draft, those three chapters might completely disappear, and you might find that your chapter three is now chapter one and the other two chapters don't exist anymore. So
yeah,
like you, I think it kind of, in some ways, I guess if agents are looking for kind of a flavor of your voice, then maybe it's helpful. But this is why people are always advised, have a full manuscript before you actually start querying, because otherwise agents might be very disappointed if you turn around and say, actually, well, I've written these three chapters.
Yeah, and I think you learn so much about yourself actually when you finish the whole manuscript, and when you're going out to agents, you do want to have a sense for yourself of what kind of writer you are and what kind of writer you want to be, and what kind of novel it is. I think when I was going back to agents, it was really helpful to have that sense in my mind of what I wanted, as well as, you know, wanting them to want me, and to really know, to understand that an agent understood what I wanted out of the book and what I thought the book was about. So it's really helpful in that sense as well to have a full thing.
It would have been a shame for you to kind of force yourself to come up with an idea and rush it, and then find that actually it wasn't the kind of novel you wanted to write, or it wasn't the idea that you wanted, and giving yourself that time and space away. I mean, it's nice that you kind of had that interest, and I think that that does happen to other people as well, where they get interested and they feel like, I've got to finish something, I've got to come up with something. But taking your time, I think, is probably the best advice. I wondered whether you could tell us a little bit about how the publishing experience has been for you, and maybe I know this is a hard ask because you've just kind of early days of being a debut, but obviously it's been about 18 months probably since you signed your contract, and you've been through all sorts of things like edits and covers and copy edits and proofreads and all that sort of thing. What kind of advice would you give to people who are maybe just about to go through that part of it? What would you say, because it's quite a kind of emotional roller coaster at times as well, so what would you say your advice would be to anyone about to go through it?
I mean, the emotional roller coaster is real for sure, so I'd say it's really normal to be feeling about a million different things at the same time, and really normal to be feeling anxious or worried about things, as well as very joyful and very grateful. I've really enjoyed the publishing experience so far. I've found it so interesting, I think, as a reader as well, to just have that peek behind the scenes of how things happen. The amount of work that goes into publishing a book is quite astounding, I think. The various teams and various people. I think one thing that's changed for me is just really trying to enjoy the process, and it's easy, as I say, to feel very anxious, to feel like your book is your child and you want it to go out into the world and be sort of protected but really there's so much that you can't control about what happens once your book is published, that you really just have to enjoy what happens, enjoy the parts where you get to meet readers and meet booksellers and meet different people at your publishers. And I'd also say as well, ask lots of questions. It can be really overwhelming just with the information you get. And there's lots of terminology that I didn't understand when I was going in, lots of different details about the system of publishing and the process of publishing that you maybe just have no idea about, which I didn't. But people were always happy to answer questions. I never felt like I was asking stupid questions, even if I possibly was. ask lots of questions, I think, and try and enjoy it.
So many acronyms in the publishing world that do not be afraid to ask, because there'll be email exchanges where agents and editors are happily saying all these strings of letters and you're looking at it thinking, I have literally no idea what that means. I definitely agree with that. I also think, you know, voice your opinion, have questions, but also try and come up with, if there's something that you're not sure about or that you don't like, try and come up with like a solution or a different possibility, because rather than just say, oh, I'm not sure about that, or I don't like that, and I think also people always worry about this, that editors are somehow out to completely change your book, and I would say, like, absolutely not. You know, working with an editor is really enjoyable, and it should be a time to just kind of really dig down deep into what your book is about and what it means, and that's, to me, that's that's really enjoyable, and it shouldn't be something to worry about too much.
I agree completely. And you can push back as well. I think that's something that I really enjoyed about working with an editorial team was you can decide what you're happy to change, but you can also decide what's really important to you actually to
Yeah,
keep in the
definitely.
book.
Even if it's just one word, it sometimes can be really important.
A full stop. Yeah.
Yeah, full stop. Yeah. Oh yeah, I've had those back and forths before. So finally, Elizabeth, I'm really keen to know if you're working on anything new at the moment.
Yes. So I am working on my second novel at the moment. I'd say the difficult second album cliche is very real. I'm deep in it at the moment. And I'm still struggling with plot. I thought I might have learned ways around that, but it seems that's just something I'm gonna face with every book. But yeah, I'll get my spreadsheets out and I'm gonna find a way through.
Yeah, spreadsheets, mood boards, anything that can kind of help stimulate the kind of storytelling part of your brain. Yeah, definitely.
Yes,
Oh well,
yeah.
I'm really excited to kind of find out what's next, but for the moment, Whalefall is out soon, and well, actually, by the time I've just fluffed that, because when I release this, it'll already be out. So what shall I say? Okay, but I'll rewind myself. Well, I'm really excited about that, but also really thrilled for you with Whalefall, and I'm sure people who love Highland books and kind of odd separate communities will love it. But thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
That was Elizabeth O'Connor talking about her literary novel, Whalefall, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.